The following program is a WYVE news special. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Craig Allison. The summer started like others before it here in the mountains of Southwest Virginia. School was out. It was time for cowboys and Indians, or dolls and jump rope. Time for the swimming pool and mountain hikes or bicycle rides. The merchants of Whitfield were gearing up for the annual influx of the tourist trade. The Whitfield Statesmen baseball team, a member of the old Blue Ridge League, was in action, and baseball fans were enjoying the evening's action at Withers Field. All in all, it appeared Whitfield and Wythe County could look forward to another pleasant, if not a hot, summer. But that was not to be. For this was the summer of 1950, the summer of our discontent. The horror began with the cries of an 18-month-old boy, the son of Mr. and Mrs. Jim Sacafico. Sacafico was second baseman for the Whitfield Statesmen and had come to Whitfield that summer from his home in Jersey City, New Jersey, to play professional baseball. It was about the 1st of July, 1950, when Jim Sacafico learned his son, Johnny, had contracted poliomyelitis, or polio, a dreaded word in those days. Although Johnny lived, he was crippled by the disease, and it was his case that began that long, dark journey through the summer of our discontent, the 1950 polio epidemic in Whitfield. Dr. C.B. Hughes had just opened his practice in Whitfield, and his training was in the field of pediatrics, children's medicine. We asked Dr. Hughes what he recalls now about that terrible summer.
The first recollection that I was in the midst of a polio epidemic was after three small children that I saw consecutively in a period of about 24 hours had a disease that killed them almost within the period it took to get them to the hospital.
Well, what did you do when you got the idea that perhaps we were headed for a horrible summer?
I felt that probably with the virulence of this disease that was having such a killing effect so early in so many people that it should be reported to the National Foundation of Polio in New York, the head of which was a friend of mine that I'd just taken a course under. And I called, and he in turn recommended that we report it to local authorities here in this state.
Well, what did the local authorities do?
The local authorities had a meeting with the doctors in Whitfield and Wythe County, and upon common agreement, we were to wait and see exactly what would happen within the next few days or week and how many more cases would be reported.
Well, how did the caseload go?
The caseload rapidly increased, and it was felt that we definitely were in an epidemic situation. And when this was brought before the health department and the National Foundation, we were considered then a epidemic area, and we had a setup then through Roanoke to send our patients down there for further treatment and distribution.
Well, when was this decided that we had an epidemic? Was it toward the beginning?
Unfortunately, the decision on whether we had an epidemic or not was delayed for several weeks, and we as doctors in the county were very disappointed because we felt that probably we should have been recognized as an epidemic area sooner.
Well, what was done locally? What was the setup here for determining whether or not a given patient had polio?
We had two small hospitals in Whitfield at the time, and We use these hospitals to bring our patients in from the home and use Spinal Tap and whatever other means we felt could better diagnose them. And then if these patients showed positive Spinal Taps, we got in touch with our station in Roanoke at the Memorial Hospital, and we would send our patients down in ambulances to the Memorial Hospital for further treatment.
Well, sort of maybe backtracking here, what is polio, and at that time, what was the state of the art of medicine as far as what was known about the disease?
Polio in 1950 was known to be a virus disease, and we had at that time a very good idea of where to attack the body, which was the brainstem and spinal cord. But the one thing that we didn't know much about was how the disease was transmitted from one person to another, and that was a big hole in our methods of prevention.
Well, these Spinal Taps you spoke of, what do you look for in that?
The Spinal Tap, we had, has always been a very good way to diagnose polio in the past, because when the virus is attacking the body, the body sets up a reaction which produces a protein material in the spinal fluid that is easily recognized.
So then you could determine from this Spinal Tap whether or not a person was suffering from the disease. Well, once this was done, I understand that there were several cases in which the disease did not show up in your Spinal Tap.
This particular epidemic was so virulent and of such an intensive nature that it was almost unbelievable to some of us how rapidly the virus would attack the system. And because the protein material that appears in the spinal fluid is a necessary reaction to the disease in the body, we felt that in some of these cases where we weren't getting a positive spinal fluid and the patient did have polio, that it was just an overwhelming reaction to the disease that would not let the body throw this up in time. And most of these cases that we had where the spinal fluid was negative and the patient did have polio invariably died.
Well, I imagine this was kind of a shock to the doctors to find that the test they were relying on most heavily sometimes didn't give them a true picture of what was going on. What did you do when you were faced with this situation?
In the beginning, it was most frustrating, and we were very, very upset, of course, because we felt like we had lost one of our main diagnostic criteria for the disease. But as we began to settle down into seeing these patients, it became clearer and more evident that we could diagnose this disease without the use of the Spinal Tap in almost 99 out of 100% of the cases. And then when we found this out, we were more able to cope with our problem, and we felt that we did a better diagnostic workup on the patients after that, and we didn't miss nearly as many as we had in the beginning.
Well, what about the feeling of the community? You were pretty close touch, I suppose, as a doctor then. And what about the feeling of the people? Were they frightened? Did they feel like it all hope was gone?
I feel that the people in the community were more or less like we were. We were stunned and could hardly believe that we were in the midst of such a thing. And being physicians and feeling this way, we realized that it must have been much more terrible on the public. And there was a great deal of panic. It had to be. Most of the people, though, tried to go along and do what we asked them to and cooperated completely. And we were very well pleased with the reaction of the society as a whole. However, as you can imagine, there were a great many emotionally unstable people that this disease and the idea of getting it affected, and we had many problems along those lines.
What are some of those problems?
The most important problem that we had was in separating out the hysterical paralysis, so-called from hysteria, emotional reaction, and the true paralysis of polio. And in some extreme cases, we even had to use a mild anesthesia with barbiturates to relax the patients so that we could find out whether they really had paralysis or whether it was hysterical paralysis.
In other words, these people, are you saying they were so frightened that they actually were paralyzed?
Yes, this is true, and it is not anything unusual in medicine to see this, because hysterical paralysis is quite common in a great many cases where there's emotional instability, and in a time of tension like this, we would expect to see something like that. And we were prepared for it and knew that it was coming, but even then, a great many times, we almost erred in our diagnosis of the patient.
Well, at that time, you were a young doctor in Withville and a young father, too. How did this affect you as a head of the family?
The only thing that I can say about that is that I'd been in practice about 1 year at that time, and naturally I was concerned about my children. We didn't know how the contact was made from one person to another. We felt that that everybody was a potential victim of the disease, and naturally I was anxious, but to be frank, I was so busy and working so much and seeing so many patients that I really didn't have much opportunity to think about it.
How about coming home when you, after being in these homes where children had contacted the disease, and you came home to your own children, what measures did you take?
I had fortunately had a small cottage in my backyard, and I was able to go over there and bathe and change my clothes and completely before I came in my own home. And when I would come back from calls and working during the day and night, I would go over there and sleep sometimes and never come into my own home. I just stay over there and live except to get my meals, and I took precautions that way, which made it a little bit easier for me.
Well, I don't believe that anything other than a diagnostic center was set up here in Withville. I believe you told me that all of the patients, once they were diagnosed, were then transported to Roanoke. How was the ambulance service?
The ambulance service was excellent. If it hadn't been, our whole system of diagnosis and treatment would have broken down. And I have nothing but the greatest respect for those men in those days that drove those ambulances day and night to take those patients there.
What help did the town, the community, get from the National Foundation, in your estimation?
This is a little bit touchy subject with me. I feel that all in all, that our aid from the National Foundation during the time of the polio epidemic was practically nil.
Do you feel like that they could have done more, or were they just bewildered about what to do with such a heavy load here?
I have never been able to quite understand their position, although I've looked back on it for many years. I never could quite reach the people that were in the National Foundation. They were always glad to come in and talk to you, but they never had anything really to say, or they never had any real suggestions about helping in the diagnosis and nursing care and treatment of the patients.
Well, now, looking back on it 20 years later, what now is different about polio, medically speaking? What do we know about it now that we didn't know then, and what has been done?
The main hole in our entire treatment of polio, of course, was in the prevention of the disease and finding out how it was transmitted. And once we broke through in the viremia stage and found out where the virus was coming from and how it was being transmitted, then polio became, we were able to master the disease because then we knew what we were up against, and we were able to stop the transmission. We were able to make cultures of the virus, and by so doing, we were able to create a vaccine which has been used as a preventive.
Well, about this vaccine, I assume you're talking about the salt vaccine.
That was the first vaccine that we used because we were able to finally culture it and finally find a way to kill its antigenic properties so that we were able to put it back in the body in a milder form and therefore build up resistance for the disease.
Well, once you have taken this particular form of the vaccine, do you have to continue booster type doses of this vaccine?
Antigen reactions in the body as a whole are subject to changes. What might we think would be a lifetime today, such as in our smallpox and some of these others, as the years go by, we find may not stand up. As enough today, we have been taking regular boosters for the polio vaccine, but it's felt that our modern vaccine now for polio, that it should be and probably will keep complete immunity at the present time for a lifetime after initial group of injections or oral method of taking in the body and a few of the booster doses. What the future holds for how long it will stand up and how many years it will be before somebody develops a polio that has had the vaccine, the future alone can tell. And so we thought for years and years that one vaccination for smallpox would do a person for life. And today, I think that even some doctors who believe that smallpox vaccination should be given every 5 years. So all of these things are subject to time and the wear and tear time has on a disease.